Today's show is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company. For a fraction of the price of traditional therapy, you can pick an experienced, licensed therapist you relate to and feel comfortable with. Each and every therapist has at least a master's degree and has completed over 3,000 hours of supervised work. To match with your perfect therapist, go to Talkspace.com/boom. And to show your support for this podcast, use code BOOM to get $30 off your first month. That's BOOM, Talkspace.com/boom, B-O-O-M.
You are Locked On Clippers, your daily Los Angeles Clippers podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
The Los Angeles Clippers scored 60 points in the paint to Utah's 36. Playing at home, they were called for 23 fouls to Utah's 16. Utah shot 22 free throws, and the Clippers only shot 8. Chris Paul, one of the grittiest players in the NBA, out there with the ball in his hands the entire game, didn't shoot a single free throw. Gordon Hayward almost shot more than the Clippers' entire team. Now, I'm not a numbers guy, but that doesn't add up. And you got a guy out here like Luke Mbamute, who in his whole time with the Clippers has never gotten a technical foul, and he doesn't get the respect from the officials that he deserves, getting called for that charge late in the game. And the Clippers don't get the respect from the officials that they deserve because guys like Luke Mbamute aren't out there going crazy. He has class and he just plays the game. And I'm sick of the refs treating the Clippers this way. You know, I know that the Jazz have this, you know, this choir boy aura surrounding the team. They're young, they haven't gotten in trouble yet. But I'm not going to let them rook us. It's unacceptable and it's unprofessional. And the Clippers really dug in and played hard this game, even though they were cold and Utah was shooting hot from three. And they earned the right to be in this game. And the referees tried to take away that chance. Take that for data. If you haven't heard David Fizdale's rant from Memphis's loss to the San Antonio Spurs in Game 2, I would definitely go check that out. It's very entertaining. And if you watched that game, it was definitely, I think, warranted, a little righteous of him to get up there and tell it how it was, because the Grizzlies did kind of get hosed in that game. And that was kind of a big, you know, I wasn't planning on incorporating that into the Locked On Clippers podcast, but that was a big part of last night's game too, between the Clippers and the Jazz. The officiating was pretty horribly one-sided, and fortunately the Clippers came out on top, so it didn't end up mattering. But that was a unique occurrence in an NBA playoff game. I don't think I've ever seen it quite go quite one-sided like that. You're listening to the Locked On Clippers podcast. Today is Wednesday, April 19th, 2017. We're in our third middle episode of the week. We've got two more episodes coming this week on Thursday and Friday as the Clippers get ready for games 3 and 4 in Utah of this series, which is now tied 1-1 following Clippers' 99-91 win in Los Angeles in Game 2 last night. I'm your host, Lucas Hand. So, kind of the numbers I guess we might as well start off talking about the officiating a little bit and just get it out of the way, because I dropped that so early in the episode. But those numbers were crazy. I mean, for the Clippers to have been so much more aggressive than the Jazz going to the basket. The Jazz shooting way more threes, the Clippers driving to the basket more, scoring more points in the paint, and for the Clippers to only have 8 free throws attempted, really only 6, because 2 of them came in the closing seconds of the game when Utah was intentionally fouling to try to keep the game alive. So the Clippers really only had 6 free throws attempted, all in the first half. When's the last time an NBA team didn't shoot a free throw in a half? I mean, we're not talking about like, oh, they shot 22 free throws and we shot 16. They got more than we did. 22-6. When the Clippers were the aggressors. It's not, you know, you see games like this sometimes where the free throw disparities are so huge. And then you look a little deeper in the box score and you see that one team shot 7 threes and were constantly going to the rim and earning trips to the free throw line. The other team shot, you know, 36 threes and were clearly not being aggressive and settling for jump shots, and that's why they didn't get free throws. That wasn't the case in this game. In this game, the team that was decidedly more aggressive was the team that could not buy a trip to the foul line almost the entire night. So it's almost like you know, you look at any game. If the Clippers had lost this game, for example, I wouldn't want to harp too much on the officiating, even though it was horrible, because there are other things that the Clippers did poorly, things that they could have done better, areas where they need to improve, or at least have room for improvement, and you always want to focus on yourself instead of on external factors. Because once you start saying, well, it's the ref's fault, then you no longer are controlling your own fate. If you put it in the referee's hands and say, well, as long as the referees do their job, we'll win. Well, the referees sometimes make bad calls. Sometimes the referees call bad games. And you've got to win those games anyway. And so if the Clippers had lost this game, I'd be pointing towards a lot of other factors and saying, even though the referees were horrible, you need to do a better job as a team to make it not come down to that. But I think one thing that we can just honestly look at following last night's game and going forward into the other games in the series is that the Clippers should be helped out by the fact that the officiating should return to a more moderate average that you'd expect. That doesn't mean there's not going to be blown calls in both directions, and maybe there will be another bad game, and maybe it'll favor the Clippers, and maybe it won't. But in general, the Clippers' margin of victory would have been much larger if this game had been officiated at a professional quality, which it really wasn't. And I expect, just based off of watching a lot of NBA basketball games, you get duds like this from the officials sometimes, just like you get duds from teams sometimes. But I'd expect, on a larger sample size, the Clippers to get more fair treatment from the officials moving forward, which will help them, because they kind of got hosed in this last game. And what's interesting, and I'm not trying to draw any sort of crazy conspiracy here, is that the spread for this game was actually 9, and the officiating kind of kept the game close throughout. The Clippers ended up only winning by 8. So that's, you know, anytime a game finishes right around the spread, you're going to hear rumblings from people, well, the refs, you know, because one little thing can change the game so much. But, I mean, one way to look at it is that the Jazz are actually 2-0 against the spread in this series, because they covered in this game, and they obviously won game one where the Clippers were favored. Now, I know actually a lot of people listen to this podcast and to other podcasts because they're trying to get some sort of insight or advice or home team analysis for their gambling choices if you do online sports betting. With the NBA playoffs having just tipped off, if you're a sports bettor and you're listening to this show to try to get some advice, I would really recommend that you head to BetDSI for all of your playoff hoops actions. They've got over 20 years in the business, and they're one of the top-rated businesses on sportsbook review sites. They've got a great mobile product that's easy to use anywhere, and on my laptop I went on the other day and checked out the website, and it's really super smooth and straightforward and easy to use. It's not, you know, I wasn't getting nasty pop-ups or anything like you get sometimes from these gambling sites. And they offer live in-game wagering so that you can make plays throughout entire games and events. BetDSI has great customer service available 24/7, 365 days a year, so that you never have to worry about having any issues. And they've built a reputation over their 20 years in the sports betting business of fast payment on winnings, so you never have to worry about when you're going to get your money. What's best, though, is that they've given my listeners a unique opportunity to get a free $25 just to try their service, just for registering for an account. And then you'll get a 200% bonus on your first deposit. But you have to use this promo code. The promo code is LOCK25, L-O-C-K-25. So make sure you go to BetDSI, put in the promo code LOCK25 to get a free $25 to try service just for registering, and then a 200% bonus on your first deposit. Now, aside from the officiating, which obviously is going to help the Clippers as it reverts to the mean later on in the series, there are a few other things that the Clippers need to do better or can do better. One obvious, straightforward one is three-point shooting. In the first two games of the series, the Jazz are averaging 42% from deep. The Clippers are averaging 32% from deep. Both teams shot about 37% on the season. Utah, 37.2%. The Clippers, 37.5%. So it's not like the Clippers you'd expect to necessarily be out shooting the Jazz, but you would reasonably really be expecting them to at least be close or slightly ahead. It's surprising to see in these two games Utah shooting 42%, 5% above their season average, while the Clippers shoot 32%, 5% below their season average. That's something that not necessarily will correct over the course of a series, but I mean, we've seen teams get hot for a series or cold for a series. It's possible that the Clippers play a whole series shooting 5% below their season average. It's possible that the Jazz play a whole series shooting 5% above their season average. But you'd hope that that shooting corrects and the Clippers can get, you know, I mean, we saw in the one game that Utah beat the Clippers in the regular season, they got insanely hot from deep. That was the only reason they won that game. Otherwise, the Clippers creamed them in the other three contests. Utah's been hot from deep in these two games. Not as hot as they were in that game when they beat the Clippers in March, but still well above their season average. And the Clippers have been especially cold. If both these teams go back to 37%, the Clippers have to be feeling really good about their chances. There were a couple other quirks in this game that really limited the Clippers. And, you know, I'm not sure the result would have been too much different. I predicted in yesterday's podcast, if you listened, that this would be an 8 to 12 point win for the Clippers, and that they'd have defensive problems throughout the game that would keep them from really going on the type of run that they needed to put the Jazz away. And so even though the Clippers' defense, you might say, well, they only allowed 91 points, the problem was that even when the Clippers were clicking on offense, they were never able to get those consistent stops to go on the type of 12-2 run that you need to push a 10-point lead to a 20-point lead. And the problem with that, the reason why I predicted that that would be the case, is that Utah went to their perimeter scorers, and the Clippers don't have the perimeter defenders to match up with them. Gordon Hayward, George Hill, Rodney Hood, Joe Johnson, you put those four guys on the floor around a guy like Derek Favors in the middle, and the Clippers really struggled to come up with four players on their second unit to cover those four guys. Felton has played very good defense in this series. Chris Paul and Luke Mbamute are obviously both great defenders. The Clippers don't have a fourth guy. And even having those three is limiting because you don't necessarily want to be forced to play Paul, Felton, and Mbamute against Utah's second unit. Now, obviously, it's not a pure second unit because you've got Hayward and Hill in there, but the point being, you can't always have Chris Paul on the floor. The Clippers have done a pretty good job of always having Luke Mbamute on the floor when Gordon Hayward is playing, but having Chris Paul out there defensively to guard George Hill is not the game plan. And Raymond Felton, while he's played good defense, is undersized going against Rodney Hood or Joe Johnson. So the Clippers are really missing Austin Rivers. And, you know, this is a point that I made before, and it will continue to just be a reality of the series until he's back, that because they are so short on capable wing defenders, they really miss him while he's out. But that's why I predicted that they wouldn't be able to pull away from this game, because I figured Utah was always going to have at least one guy who was being semi-productive as a perimeter scorer that was going to keep the Clippers from going on these crazy runs, and you really need to play good defense to go on runs in the NBA. It's not just about scoring, because NBA teams all have players who are talented enough to score with you unless you're also playing really good defense. So the Clippers ended up winning by 8. There were a couple other quirks, though. One of them being Chris Paul's foul trouble. Now, Chris Paul, DeAndre Jordan, and J.J. Redick all struggled with foul trouble in this game. But Chris Paul was the guy who was most limited by it minutes-wise. He picked up his second foul in the first quarter and his third in the second. So there were chunks of the first half where he wasn't playing his normal amount of minutes because of that foul trouble. So he actually finished the first half with 13 minutes, and he finished the game with 33. So he played 13 of 24 minutes in the first half, 20 of 24 in the second half, again, because of that foul trouble in the first half. Raymond Felton, who played 17 minutes, played 12 in the first half and 5 in the second half. Again, you get the idea. He's playing, Felton had to play a lot, almost, Felton played really more than a full game's worth of backup minutes in the first half alone, just because of Chris Paul's foul trouble. So that definitely limited the Clippers when they were playing so well in the first half from building that lead to an even higher margin earlier in the game, because they were playing without Chris Paul, and Chris Paul was a huge part of what they were doing. He actually had a worse box score stat line than he did in game one, but I thought he played a much more complete game. And a big part of it, I thought, was something that Doc Rivers had talked about in press conferences and something that I'd really been stressing over the last few days. When he came off of those screens from DeAndre Jordan or Blake Griffin, instead of taking those kind of drag dribbles and floating out to the side and moving laterally, he turned the corner and attacked downhill going to the basket. And Amar from SLC Dunk made the point when Doc Rivers was talking about the Clippers needing to attack the rim more, that the Clippers don't really have guards who attack the rim. Austin Rivers does, but he's out. Raymond Felton does, but he's playing in a very minor role. Chris Paul, J.J. Redick, and Jamal Crawford, all of them, less than 10% of their shots come at the rim. So you're saying we need to attack the rim more. Well, who is that? Okay, Blake Griffin is going to put the ball on the floor and go to the basket, but Luke Mbamute isn't. Chris Paul doesn't do that. J.J. Redick doesn't do that. Jamal Crawford doesn't do that. So it's, what, Blake Griffin and Raymond Felton are the two guys that you're going to be putting this load on? But my response to Amar, and this was before Game 2 tipped off, was that it's not about shooting. It's about aggressively attacking and making Derek Favors or whoever else is playing center for the Jazz at that time come help on the drive. And that opens up a whole world of opportunities as far as throwing the lob to DeAndre, which we saw a lot of last night, or kicking out to shooters, because you're making Derek Favors pick. When you take those drag dribbles, you let him stretch his arms out and hedge and pop back, and you let George Hill fight over the screen, and you give them time to recover. But when you come off that screen and you turn and you drive right at Derek Favors, you force him to commit to you, and then you can throw that lob. Now, this might not necessarily work as well when Rudy Gobert comes back, because Rudy Gobert has such insane length and athleticism and defensive instinct that you might rather than against Gobert take those drag dribbles and force him to take a couple steps out and kind of stretch him out a little bit more. But against a more vulnerable interior defender like Derek Favors, who's still struggling with his conditioning coming back from injuries, like Boris Diaw or Jeff Withey, go attack them. And that's something that the Clippers really should have done in Game 1 as soon as Rudy Gobert got hurt. They didn't execute that in Game 1. They did it much more effectively tonight. It's why we saw DeAndre Jordan, who only had 10 points in Game 1, had 18 points tonight on 9 of 11 shooting. Blake Griffin, even though he had a much less efficient game than he did in Game 1, I thought was more effective going to the basket aggressively, less settling for jump shots in Game 1. Chris Paul, far more effective and balanced as an attacking both scorer and distributor. And then, even off the bench, Paul Pierce drove to the rim a few times. Raymond Felton and Mo Spates both had a little bit of offensive success. And I want to talk a little bit more about those bench performances in the next segment, but I think that was a big deal for the Clippers. Really pushing the ball, turning the corner on those screen and rolls, and attacking Derek Favors instead of putting, you know, it's like in Game 1, they put them in these tough spots. You come in this pick and roll with the floor spaced, and it's like you got the jugular, and you just let it go. And in Game 2, they went in, and they really took him out. And that's what they needed to do, and it's what they need to do going forward. Again, you might need to adjust again when Rudy Gobert comes back, if Rudy Gobert comes back. But for right now, as long as Gobert is not playing, this is the formula. Because the Clippers scored 99 points in a low-tempo game, shooting 30% from deep. If the Clippers get hot from deep, I mean, if the Clippers have the shooting night that you'd expect them to have from deep, they would have had 6 more points, and instead of an 8-point win, it's a 14-point win. If they get hot from deep, now you're talking a 20-point win. If they maybe get some foul calls, you're stretching that out even more. And obviously you can't, you know, it's not that simple to say, oh, well, 3 more points here and 2 more points here. It's a vast oversimplification of how the game works, but it just kind of gives you an idea that the Clippers offense was great in this game. They just didn't shoot very well. So they were consistently manufacturing good looks. Obviously, they got so many dunks and layups going to the basket. The offense was clicking. It was flowing. But when they did swing the ball out, they weren't hitting. And that's not, you know, necessarily anything that's the Clippers' fault. You have hot nights and you have cold nights, and that's just how it goes. But in general, I think that's a good sign. It shows that this was maybe a below-average performance considering how the quality of execution that the Clippers had. Now, briefly, I want to talk about J.J. Redick, because J.J. Redick struggled again in this game, again, very smothered by the defense of Joe Ingles. He had 4 points on 2 of 7 shooting. He missed both his threes. He had 5 personal fouls. I think his struggles really came more on the defensive end tonight. Seemed like he always had his hand where it shouldn't have been, kind of reaching in, fouling shooters, fouling guys on the drive. And I think a lot of that might have been a little him being over-anxious, over-eager to try to make a play because he's being so smothered offensively. And I think we saw that too. Whenever JJ did get a chance and he missed, he was in his own head. He was frustrated because his chances have been so few and far between, which is not normal for him. I think he's been shut out of these 2 games. Probably it's the most shut out he's been of any 2 games this season. But what's interesting is that I think in the first game, I don't think he provided very much value to the Clippers because they were force-feeding him and he was turning the ball over. In this game, I think the Clippers were a lot more calm and decisive as they read their options on offense, and I think they made the right play a lot more often, and a lot of times that means not going to J.J. Redick because he's being smothered. But if J.J. Redick is being smothered, that means the lane is that much more open for the DeAndre Jordan lob. And so even though J.J. was 2 of 7, I think the box score doesn't tell you what watching the game tells you. What watching the game tells you is that those 9 buckets that DeAndre Jordan had, many of them would not have been possible if someone else had been playing other than J.J. Redick and you hadn't had the spacing that J.J. Redick can provide. And we even saw plays where J.J. Redick would get open and miss a shot, and or plays, especially in the second half, J.J. Redick started to get a little more space, and he would drive, and he'd shoot a floater and miss, and DeAndre Jordan would get the rebound and put it back. Again, DeAndre Jordan might not be able to get that rebounding positioning if the entire defense isn't shifting around, chasing J.J. Redick, and then helping when he beats his man. So I actually think he contributed positively to this win tonight, even though he didn't have a great individual scoring performance. I think his offensive, I think his motion on offense and the way that he draws the defense and sort of just using him as a decoy the entire night was a big part of the Clippers being able to be so successful offensively inside, because Redick is such a deadly weapon and such an effective decoy that the defense stays glued to him, and that opens the lane up so well. Now, just briefly talking about these bench performances. Paul Pierce had one of his better games of the season, actually, with 6 points and 2 assists in 9 minutes, but the reality is he's still not playing at an NBA level. He made 3 of 4 shots, which is nice because, you know, obviously it's better for a guy to make 3 of 4 than 1 of 4, but nothing about his offensive game tonight screams sustainable to me. It's not like he's making threes again and you're saying, well, he can be a spot-up shooter off the bench. It's just that, you know, he was in the right place at the right time a couple of plays. And that's fine. I don't want to take that away from him that he got those 6 points. But despite shooting well, the Clippers were still -2 in the 9 minutes that Paul Pierce played. and plus 10 in the 39 minutes that he didn't play. And when you watch, if you really watch defensively, every single possession he's out there, he's hurting the team. He doesn't move well enough to play defense at an NBA level, and especially how I discussed earlier in the episode and what I've kind of been harping on, where the Jazz have so many options to score the ball on the perimeter. Paul Pierce is out there guarding one of those guys. He's guarding Joe Johnson in this game a lot. Joe Johnson, who, now it's not like Jamal Crawford did any better against Joe Johnson than Paul Pierce did, but he's being torched defensively. And so I still don't think that Paul Pierce should be playing. I'd rather play Allen Anderson. I'd rather play Wesley Johnson. I'd rather stick to an 8-man rotation and play Mo Spates as the backup power forward. All of that, in my mind, is preferable to giving Paul Pierce these minutes. Hopefully, when Austin Rivers returns, which it's sounding like should be in Game 4, hopefully when Austin Rivers returns, Doc sticks with that 9-man rotation, Pierce goes back to not playing, and everyone can kind of live happily ever after. But, I mean, there was one really, really bad lineup to start the fourth quarter of this game. I think it was Felton, Redick, Crawford, Pierce, and Spates, which is like the worst defensive lineup imaginable. I mean, if you looked at the 9 players the Clippers play, you took out the 3 clear best defenders are Mbamute, Jordan, and Paul. The 4th best defender, well, Felton has played pretty good defense in the series. Redick is okay. Griffin is okay. You know, whatever. But Griffin is obviously a superstar that helps make up for it on the offensive end with his scoring. So you have one solid defender out there, a couple guys in Redick and Spates who are okay but limited, and 2 horrible defenders in Pierce and Crawford. And you're playing small with guys who aren't great rebounders, 3 guards, and Pierce, who really struggles at rebounding at the power forward position, and Spates, who is only okay as a rebounding center because he's more of a shooter. And you don't have a lot of offense out there because Redick doesn't create for himself. Crawford's having a horrible game. Pierce is so unreliable. Spates is streaky. Raymond Felton is shooting 8% from 3 since March 1st. That lineup was a disaster. I mean, fortunately, Utah had a couple of turnovers, and they were only out there for 2 minutes, so they managed to get out relatively unscathed. But I'm just wondering, like, what even got into Doc Rivers' mind that they went into the break between the third and fourth quarters, and those were the 5 guys he chose to put out on the floor. But, I mean, that's not even anything about the individual players, to be honest, because they all have their strengths and weaknesses. You know, I mean, Paul Pierce is pretty bad, but the other guys all have utility. You just have to use them right. Mo Spates and Raymond Felton, I thought, both had very good games. Felton, especially in the first half, where he had to fill in a little more heavily for Chris Paul because of the foul trouble. And then in the second half, he finally hit a 3. Felton finished in 17 minutes with 5 points, 5 assists, 2 rebounds, and a steal. He made a 3. He shot 2 of 5 from the field. He only had 1 turnover. Minus 2 in 17 minutes for Raymond Felton is not bad when you consider that he's playing with the bench unit, and when you consider that the guy he's replacing is Chris Paul, who is, you know, one of the best point guards to ever play the game. If you go minus 2 in the minutes Chris Paul's out, you should be good enough to go more than plus 2 in the minutes when Chris Paul is playing. And maybe against a team like the Golden State Warriors, that has to change, and you have to win games with the second unit and try to keep it close with the starters. But in this series, because Utah has a better bench than the Clippers, that was a pretty solid performance from Felton. Mo Spates, 3 of 4 from the field, 1 of 2 from deep, 3 rebounds, 7 points in 13 minutes. That's kind of just what you need from Mo. You need him to come in and hit a couple shots, clean the glass on the second unit so that you stop Utah's subs from getting offensive rebounds and getting tons of extra possessions. And he tried to take a charge. It was a 50-50 call. It got called a block. He's not a shot blocker, and, you know, the team defense suffers when he comes in for DeAndre because obviously DeAndre is a much bigger presence. But as far as a stopgap, I think Mo had a very solid game as a backup center. And I'd be a lot, you know, if I was Doc Rivers, I would be very willing to experiment more with Spates and Jordan playing together, because that's a lineup that, even though it feels a little clunky when you think about it, they've been very successful in the limited minutes that Doc Rivers has given them in different situations over the course of the season. Now, I wouldn't play them together when Derek Favors and Joe Johnson are sharing the floor, but when Boris Diaw is in at power forward, I feel like you can match Spates up with Diaw and Jordan up with either Withy or Favors, whoever's in at center. And then Blake Griffin should be the guy, honestly, that they're using against Joe Johnson most of the time. So when Utah goes too big, that's your chance. Buy Blake, you know, 2 to 4 minutes of rest. Put Spates in at power forward, because Spates is a better player than Paul Pierce anyway. So if you can buy minutes for him at that position, you want to do it whenever you can. I think that would work out pretty well. Jamal Crawford had another really bad game. 3 of 12 from the field, 0 of 5 from deep. Totally letting Joe Johnson just drive to the rim for floaters and layups whenever he was matched up with him. It's almost to the point where Felton, because he can't shoot, and Crawford, because he can't shoot and can't defend, I'm trying to decide like who shouldn't be in the rotation, and both of them are kind of hurting the team. The reality is, I think the Clippers really sorely miss Austin Rivers, and when Austin comes back, and if he's healthy and playing like himself, I think he's going to really establish himself as not only the third guard, but in certain situations, maybe more of a tied for second guard with J.J. Redick, because J.J. Redick has drawn so much defensive attention, and Austin Rivers has been shooting the ball much better this season, so he's a little more viable of an option as the floor spacer. But I think Austin Rivers should really be the go-to backup point guard, shooting guard, and small forward because of the limited options that the Clippers have on the roster. And that doesn't mean that Felton and Crawford won't play. Obviously, you need to play more than one guy at those three positions on the bench. But we shouldn't be seeing 24 minutes and 12 shots for Jamal Crawford when, over his playoff career as a Clipper, he's never shot 40% in one postseason. And just look at these last two games. 4 of 12 and then 3 of 12, combined 0 of 9 from deep. A total of 18 points on 24 shots. It's not good. It's really bad. It's really, really bad. So, you know, Jamal's hurting the team a lot out there. And you know, it's so hard because he can go out in one fourth quarter and hit 4 of 5. And not only does that fix his percentages for the game, but it totally changes the game. At the same time, there were times in last night's game, I tweeted, Jamal Crawford is the most selfish basketball player I've ever watched, because he's out there with the starters taking deep contested threes early in the shot clock on a night when he's cold, when the game plan is to go to the rim and Chris Paul is playing well and Blake Griffin's playing well and DeAndre Jordan is playing excellently. And Jamal Crawford's out there early in the shot clock taking deep contested threes. Why? The only reason he's either stupid or selfish. Those are the only two reasons to be taking that shot. Either you're not smart enough to realize that it's a dumb thing to do, or you're so selfish that you don't care that it's a dumb thing to do because you want to get your shot, you want to try to get your points. There's no excuse for some of the shots that he took in last night's game. And that's not to say every shot is bad. There was one play with the starters where I think Blake Griffin was the guy who drove. He drew help. He kicked out. The ball swung around to Chris Paul, who swung it to Jamal in the corner. Jamal drove past his man baseline and shot a nice little 12-foot floater. He missed. That's okay. It's a good possession, a ball reversal, a drive, and a missed shot. It happens. But then you get times when he's quadruple-teamed, taking an off-balance jumper that he clanks horribly while four other guys are standing there going, dude, I'm open. And then you have times, like I said, where early in the shot clock, playing with the starters, he's forcing up horrible shots when he could be running the offense and letting someone who actually contributes to the team's success have a chance to touch the ball. So it's just incredibly frustrating to watch him play basketball on nights like these last couple of games. It's just very, very frustrating. So we actually have a couple off days now, again, between games 2 and 3, there are 2 days off. So Game 3 of this series won't occur until Friday night in Utah. And those are going to be two tough games. I mean, Utah's got a very good home court advantage. They're going to have a very loud, energetic crowd after having an extended stretch of not being in the postseason. So it's going to be a tough environment for the Clippers, but I think they really need to win one of these next two games and then come home and win Game 5 so that Game 6 in Utah isn't an elimination game. Just quickly running through the other results in the NBA. Toronto beat Milwaukee in what was essentially a must-win for the Raptors. They're going to be in the same boat as the Clippers, now going into two games in Milwaukee, needing a split to come back home for Game 5, tied 2-2. And Boston, the one seed in the East, lost a second home game to the 8-seed Chicago Bulls. So now Boston is going to Chicago down 2-0 for Games 3 and 4. And Boston hasn't won in Chicago since November 2014. That's crazy. Because Boston's so much better than Chicago. And that they lost these two games at home. We've seen 8s upset 1s before. It's pretty rare in the NBA, but we've seen it a few times. I don't think we've ever seen an 8 sweep a 1. And that's really in play with these. This game wasn't close. Chicago won by 14. So that's going to be pretty fascinating to watch play out, even though it's kind of far away from the Clippers. Wednesday night's NBA action. Atlanta is visiting Washington. Washington's up 1-0 in the series. Atlanta trying to steal a game away from home and get home court advantage. Oklahoma City visiting Houston. Again, trying to steal a game away from home and get home court advantage. They really got rolled by the Rockets in Game 1. So Russell Westbrook and company might have a little bit to prove to show that they belong in this series. Portland visiting Golden State. I think this is actually going to be a pretty big blowout in Golden State's favor. Portland seemed to get the breaks that they needed in Game 1. CJ McCollum was making ridiculous shots all game. It was close through three quarters. And then Golden State pulled away in the fourth. I think that Golden State's so much better than Portland. The Trailblazers aren't going to get a second chance to try to make something happen. I think they had their chance. It didn't materialize. Maybe they'll win one of their games at home to force a game back to game to force the series back to Game 5 in Golden State, but I'm not particularly interested in this Portland Golden State game. Hopefully I'm wrong. But I just think Golden State is going to they had a chance to catch the Warriors napping and they couldn't quite pull it off. I don't think they're going to catch them napping in Game 2. If you have any comments, questions, or feedback about the show, feel free to hit me up on Twitter at LucasJHan or email me lhan.clipsnation@gmail.com. Go ahead and follow the Clips Nation Twitter at ClipsNationSBN. Check out the Clips Nation blog at ClipsNation.com and like Clips Nation on Facebook by just typing Clips Nation in the Facebook search bar. I did a Facebook Live question and answer on the Clips Nation page, so if you turn on notifications for live videos, you'll get a little notification on your phone when I go live. I've done it in each of the first two games. I'll probably keep doing it going forward because the engagement has been pretty good and people seem to like it. So at halftime of the game, you can just mute your TV and watch me answer your questions for 10 or 15 minutes. That's pretty cool. And if you like the show, please make sure to subscribe on iTunes and leave a good review. And listen tomorrow for Thursday's episode of Locked On Clippers. Thanks, guys. This is Luke Sand signing off.